February the 15th, 2019. The time is 8:30. I now call this meeting of the Finance Commission to order pursuant to Chapter 551 of the Government Code. Hector Serna contacted me and indicated that he will not be able to attend the meeting. He requested that his absence be excused. Hector is in Guadalajara for a wedding, one of the most beautiful cities in the world, and has the best temperature, and I envy him being there. In accordance with Finance Commission Code 11.103, the commission members will take a vote to either accept or deny this request. All in favor of excusing the absence say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say no. The ayes have it, and the absence is excused. There is a quorum with 9 members present. Members, we will take the consent agenda up in a minute. If there's anyone wishing to address the commission during the time of the public comment, please fill out a witness affidavit form and bring it to the front. Public comments on non-agenda items are limited to 5 minutes and agenda items for 10 minutes. Do we have any cards?
Okay.
In accordance with the Finance Commission's policy on testimony, public comment are not allowed on agenda items related to final rule adoptions, except for the majority vote of the Commission, which comments are limited to 10 minutes. To go into the consent agenda. Members, before we take up the consent agenda item 1A, the minutes, in a single vote, I want to state that any commission member may request that an agenda item may be removed from the consent agenda and be placed on the regular agenda so that it may be discussed and voted on individually. Do I hear a motion to adopt the consent agenda item A1 without discussion?
So moved.
Moved by Molly.
Second.
Second by Lori. All in favor, any discussion? All in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The ayes have it, and the motion carries. Move to Finance Commission Operations. Commissioner Cooper.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm going to discuss some items going on in the legislature right now, and then after I get through, if Mr. Pettijohn or Commissioner Jones have anything to add, feel free to do so. But if my calendar is correct, we have 101 days left in session, but who's counting? Yesterday, the three commissioners testified before the new PIPS committee. Pensions, Investments, and Financial Services, and it was an organizational meeting, so each commissioner kind of talked a little bit about what their agency does. Sunset, at the beginning of the meeting, Sunset staff did do a presentation on their review of the three agencies, and they were, I'll use the term complimentary. And I thought the meeting was very productive. There's a new Chairman Murphy from Houston, or Katie, and then several of the other members are new to this area, or the financial services type industry. And so we had a lot of questions, but I thought it was a very good session. A couple of things I'd like to mention. One thing they did say yesterday were that the bills had to be in Ledge Council today if they were going to come out. So even though to me it seems kind of early, it's session's moving along very quickly. There was a bill filed by Senator Birdwell, who is chairman of the Sunset Commission, about SDSI agencies acquiring properties. And we've evaluated the bill, assuming that it gets passed. It requires SDSI agencies to do several things. I will say that generally speaking, we've already done those. For instance, you have to contact the governor's office, you have to contact the facilities commissions, et cetera, and we've already done all those things, so we'll have to go through it again, but it's nothing new to us. Then the sunset bills have been filed, and I think they're going to separate them. The OCCC is going to be in one bill, and then Savings and Mortgage Lending and Department of Banking will be in another. And Leslie, I believe that your bill has been filed in the House. Has it been filed in the Senate?
Yes, yes.
Both House and the Senate. And for the Department of Banking and Savings and Mortgage Lending, I believe it's only been filed in the House at this point in time. Any comments about that from you on the sunset bill? Okay, it's just kind of everything that the report contained, the sunset report contained, or in these bills. I talked to the author of the sunset bill for our two agencies yesterday, and I do think there may need to be some wordsmithing, but we agreed to talk about that a little bit later. And I'm sure there are other things to discuss about the legislature, but that's all I have. Leslie or Caroline, do y'all have anything you want to talk about?
No, at least as far as sunset bills, et cetera, I think you've covered for those.
I may have a couple comments I'll pick up within my normal report, but I think that's fine for the Iowa Finance Commission.
Okay, that's all we have then.
Okay, let's move on to the Audit Committee report. You know, members, we've sort of changed our processes here on some recommendations, and so we've moved the Audit Committee to Thursday afternoons, and we had our first meeting yesterday. I'll ask Chairman Curl to lead us through that, but we're sort of feeling our way how to make sure that you get all the information you need from the Audit Committee. So when it comes time for discussion, I'd encourage you to ask any questions that you have of us to make sure that we've covered that. Chairman Curl?
Okay. The Audit Committee would like to make a motion that the Finance Commission approve the agency's November 30th, 2018 investment officer reports.
And of course, those are in your book. Coming on the recommendation of the Audit Committee, no second is needed. Is there any discussion? All in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The ayes have it and the motion passes.
The Audit Committee would like to make a motion that the Finance Commission approve the agency's 2019 first quarter financial statements.
Coming on the recommendation of the Audit Committee, no second is needed. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, all in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The ayes have it and the motion carries.
I think that's all I have.
Okay, thank you, Molly. The next items would be taken up in the executive session, which we'll have at the end of the meeting. Items 6 and 10 are the items that we'll take up in executive session. That leads us to item B, SML.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Savings and mortgage lending begins on page 19. But before I talk about the materials in the book, I want to give you some information about the shutdown and how that impacted our regulated industries on a high level. First of all, we were in contact with both each state savings banks as well as with stakeholders in the mortgage industry to determine how things were going along during the shutdown and then again at the end of the shutdown. So some items that were of importance to these two industries were the National Flood Insurance Program. FEMA stopped issuing new policies and stopped issuing renewals for flood insurance. They started back up again prior to the end of the shutdown on December 31st. So there was relief at that point. With regard to income verifications through the IRS, those stopped for a time, and which impeded the processing of the mortgage applications because they could not get income verification for Fannie, Freddie, or FHA loans. That resumed January 14th. Other items that we were monitoring and heard from the stakeholders were that HUD was shut down, so FHA wasn't able to underwrite or approve new loans. USDA was shut down, and also heard anecdotally of instances in which an originator was in the process of working on a loan with a federal employee, and the federal employee felt skittish about continuing with that process and backed out. So the amount of impact depended on what products the particular institution or mortgage company was offering. So I'll give you that.
So along those lines, obviously there are a lot of our colleagues who work in the federal government who were impacted by the shutdown. Do we have any sense of anything we could do to help those employees in the interim in the event this comes back again? Same question for the other two. Yes.
Well, in terms of the federal financial agencies that we work with, they were not shut down because they are not under the laws that would have them shut down during what their, I guess, equivalent SDSI. Mm-hmm. That's not the right way to say it, I'm sure. But in terms of helping federal employees who were impacted, we did encourage in the savings banks to, or not encourage, we did recommend, as did the federal agencies, that they look at these situations case by case and offer deferrals where appropriate. And so we did agree with that.
Thank you.
So on page 19 on the written materials, with regard to the state savings banks, this is one of those meetings where the financial data from the FDIC isn't finalized, so we'll have more detailed reporting for you on them in April. I will point out 92% of the savings institutions are well rated, and we have 2 formal enforcement actions. Under charters and merger activity, we've received an application from Spirit of Texas Bank SSB to acquire First National Bank of Beeville in Beeville. So that application is in process. At this point, on page 20 is information about the annual fee assessments, which we bring to at this point in the year, and I'm going to call on Antonia to discuss this information.
Antonia Ento of Savings and Mortgage Lending. On page 20, we're presenting to you the assessment rates as they were approved by you in last year in February meeting for comparison purposes, and this year's assessment rates. We're decreasing the assessment rates by 10% following the same decrease that OCC did for calendar year 2019, and since our rates are tied to theirs at 50%, we have to do the same decrease. This is the first reduction of marginal assessment rates that they do, as far as I can remember. There is no inflation adjustment this year. So far, they've been doing annually small inflation adjustments, but no reduction like that. So we have to follow their decrease, and this is what we're presenting to you. These are going to be the assessment rates through the end of the fiscal year. We are going to bill for the third quarter, we're going to bill our banks 50% of OCC rates, and fourth quarter, one half of that. This is how it was budgeted.
Do we want to bring up that this new effective rates go through August, so when it comes time for the budgeting process, that we might move away from having it just be 50% of the OCC rate, but you know, the thought that we're discussing is whether or not it should be no greater than, so we can have some flexibility in that.
Yes. Yeah, we are. That's why we're setting these rates only through the end of the fiscal year. We are considering what to bring into the Finance Commission to address some of the sunset findings.
Right.
And address evening out the quarterly assessments. And we will be presenting this in a later meeting this year.
Right. Okay.
In preparation of next year's budget.
Right, which will be a change for the bankers because they're used to having the fourth quarter, you know, eliminated. And so the thought being next year we'll even it off so that mm-hmm. every quarter it's the same.
And And as you said, it's a change, so we will, once we know what we're really, what we are going to do, we will be communicating that early and often.
Right, right. Just wanted to start that initial communication going on, so.
Yeah, once we know, once this is approved, if it is approved, we will be communicating to the banks the change that is happening now, and that it's only valid through August, and that there will be potentially more changes for the next fiscal year.
Right, okay, great, thank you.
Refresh me on basically OCC, we're not, are we talking Office of Consumer Credit?
No.
No, I'm sorry, this is Office of the Comptroller of the Currency. This is the federal regulator.
Be one of those indexes.
Yeah, they regulate federal savings associations and national banks, but for purposes of this.
The premier organization.
What was the name of that again?
Office of the Comptroller of the Currency. Any other questions?
Members, do I hear a motion to approve the assessments to be paid by the Texas State Savings Banks?
So moved.
Second.
Moved by Phillips, second by Molly. Any discussion? All in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The ayes have it, motion carries.
Thank you. Are there any other questions about the savings before I move to the non-bank mortgage? Okay, well, on page 21, mortgage, the chart at the top of that page gives you the regulated licensee population as of 1/31/19. As you may recall, we have been, November and December, we were in renewal period for all of these licensees. Now that we have passed December 31st, if an originator did not renew, but they intended to, or they still want to originate without a gap, they must reinstate. First of all, they're now considered terminated, failed to renew, and they cannot continue originating until they either are reinstated or go through the whole renewal, the whole license process again. So if they have to reinstate by the end of February, and as of January 31st, we'd received 720 reinstatement requests. Anyone who fails to do that, then, as I said, would have to start totally over with a new application process. So, and they cannot originate until one of those two things happen. They either reinstate or they get a new license. With regard to mortgage examinations, first quarter we conducted 117 exams. I'll mention this again when we get to measures, but we did a lot higher quantity of smaller mortgage companies, which meant that there were fewer originators to examine. Consumer complaints, we're in our target for open complaints with no complaints over 180 days, and 83% being aged less than 90 days. And as I've said for years now, the loan servicing complaints is the highest category of complaints that we receive.
What's your target for that? Is it 90? I noticed that the banking department said, they didn't have any over 90. And I asked the question only because, is there a staffing issue there? Meaning that you don't have enough staff to get to all the complaints and more timely.
More timely?
Do you consider 91 to 120 days and over acceptable then?
68% were 60 days or less, 61 to 90. We're okay with that. Now, once it hits 90, 90, 120, 180, so the manager gets involved and makes sure that that we are on target to get that complaint resolved when that complaint needs to be resolved.
Okay.
Some are more complicated, and they are going to push over. But we have target dates by which we review to see what the reason is. Is it because the complainant has not brought us all the information we need? Is it because we've gotten the two parties communicating and they haven't finished? Or is it something else?
Okay.
And there are times when they go to 180 days. It just depends. But yes, so I'm okay with the aging that we have currently, given that we have stop points where we figure out why.
Okay.
Any other questions about any of those charts? I'm not going to go through them in detail, but I'd be glad to if you all have questions. On page 24, the measures, I did want to point out the one on number of licensees examined. We examined fewer than 25%. Again, they were smaller institutions, and most of companies, and most of them had less than 10 originators, which makes the number of exams conducted smaller. On fiscal operations, staffing, first quarter of 19, we had one separation, which was an interagency transfer. To bring you up more currently, December and January, we hired two new staff members, and we had two voluntary separations. And then our status of our filling of vacancies is on the bottom of page 25. One of the items under departmental operations I want to point out and commend some of our staff for, some of our senior our executive management team took their personal time to go down to the Capitol and help in building a Habitat Texas house for a Harvey victim. And we felt like although they did it on their personal time, we still saw it as a good connection with the agency and Habitat Texas since we regulate mortgage and therefore helping get people in homes, and Habitat Texas makes loans to folks so that they can, and builds homes for folks so that they can get into a house. So so we were pleased to be able to help out there. Habitat Texas is not a licensee, they're exempt under the statutes. And with that, I will take any questions before Ernest talks about legal. Okay, Ernest.
Good morning, Chairman, member of the Commission, Commissioners. Ernest Garcia, General Counsel of the Department of Savings and Mortgage Lending. As far as legal activities, we have not had any contested matters since our last commission hearing. We're waiting for one decision in the case that's mentioned in your materials. I wanted to take this moment to just kind of follow up on some comments that I made at the last Finance Commission hearing. Members of the commission might recall that I had mentioned that, and all this is public information, that the department was involved in a fairly complex contested matter before, so that involved our allegations, the departmental allegations of spoliation or destruction of evidence, alteration of evidence, and so forth. Just to put that in context, to remind you of the dates, we filed our motion on October the 18th before SOA. There was a brief hearing on November 7th. We filed a supplemental brief after that. And to date, there's still been no decision by the SOA judge. The only other thing I would say is that that case, which involves unlicensed foreclosure prevention or loan modification scheme, their target audience is not elderly individuals. Their target audience is not disabled individuals. But because they target folks that are perhaps in financial distress by virtue of their that group, they happen to capture certain individuals that are either elderly or might fall within the definition of disabled or vulnerable. I mentioned that because I'm going to briefly talk about a couple of statutory provisions, and if the chair would like, I mean, I have copies of some of the sections I'm going to reference. If you'd like those distributed, I can do that. If not, I'll just continue on briefly.
Just go ahead.
So I think we all know that we all have an obligation to report abuse of the elderly and the disabled. By elderly, I'm referring to people 65 or older. And
I just had a birthday, so I realized I'm elderly and disabled.
I had a feeling that if anybody was going to go there, it might be you. But yeah. But the other thing I would say is, coincidentally, as I was driving into the office this morning, radio report is talking about the aging population of Texas. And so for a variety of reasons, the percentage of Texans that are 65 or older, is going to just steadily increase. And so that definition is gonna play a bigger and bigger role. So we all know about the obligations to report abuse of the elderly and abuse of the disabled, and that it's a Class A misdemeanor if you don't. And y'all may recall that the financial abuse of the elderly was of concern last legislative session, and led to the passage of Texas Finance Code Chapter 280. And that provided financial institutions the ability to do certain things when they suspected financial abuse of the elderly. And it required that they report through the Texas Human Resources Code. What I've kind of come across, though, and others may have already come across this previously, is that when you're reporting abuse or suspected financial abuse of the elderly, Texas Family and Protective Services, they will certainly take the report, but if the report does not involve a caregiver of a family member, they're not going to be in a position to investigate it. And so as we regulate financial institutions that have an obligation to report, those reports will go to Family and Protective Services, but unless the person that is suspected of abusing the elderly is either a caregiver or somebody in a continuing relationship, or a family member, they themselves are not going to investigate. And yes, sir.
I have experience with this in my own family, and I just wanted to mention, just as something that bothers me, in those cases where the adult protective services are called, if the caregiver is not a licensed caregiver, they will tell you that they don't have any authority. So if you're paying someone to take care of, and I have a disabled child, so I know about this, if you're paying somebody to take care of your disabled adult, in my case in his early 30s, and it doesn't happen to be a person with a license to do that, so it's somebody who does that for a living who might not be licensed yet, and they do something that's patently wrong, unless it's a violation that would be criminal in any case, they will tell you that, well, we're sorry, we don't have any authority. Simply throw that out there as a matter of interest.
Well, it relates, because I think that hits on the point that there is a need.
Absolutely.
For more investigation. And for those of us involved in the financial industry, I think you're going to see situations where the person that is suspected of financial abuse isn't going to be within the definition of caretaker or family member.
That's
could
right.
be somebody else that says,
that's right,
I'm with the IRS, or I'm a Nigerian prince and I've got this money, or whatever, we need to do this transaction. And so the financial institution certainly now has some additional protections and so forth with respect to holes under the finance code. But I'm talking from an investigative standpoint.
So I would point out that in an earlier part of my life, for 10 years, I was the vice chairman of the Harris County MHMR. And that was one of the issues that we were trying to get changed more than once, unsuccessfully. But in the last session, about the same time, I think I came on this commission 3 years ago, and right in advance of the last session, I got a call from Lieutenant Governor, who asked me if there were any issues that I wanted him to address that we had missed in the past. And he had a great interest in that. That particular one didn't advance, and then I resigned from that group and got here, and I haven't really been active in that area. But I would strongly encourage, if anybody knows anyone that wants to push a bill that has some involvement in that, I would support it, and I think that whole community would support it. There's a real need.
I agree with you, sir. There is a real need. I think the other side of the coin is the cost.
Right.
And there's going to be there's going to be a substantial cost, more investigators, more resources, and so forth. I only laid this out because it was an important issue in the last session. We did get that new section in the finance code. Financial institutions have a little bit more leeway in that area and protection in that area. But I think we're probably all going to see a greater and greater interest, if not this session, in the not too distant future, regarding continued concern of protecting vulnerable adults, the disabled, the elderly, the fact that we've got a growing population, and that the resources may or may not exist there. The reporting isn't there, And I've reached out to Family and Protective Services. Don't have an answer for you, but I've tried to get an idea of what percentage of financial institution reporting in the financial exploitation area, what percentage of that involves somebody other than a family member or a caretaker. I'm hoping they'll have that statistic for us, but I'd be interested in that.
Ernest, are there states that have model legislation that we could look to, or do we know?
I don't know, but I would be happy to look. You know, obviously Texas moved in a good direction last session. I think that, as I said a moment ago, there's going to continue to be movement in this area, but there will be a cost associated with it. And so how much traction or how much interest there is, or say it another way, what's the appetite going to be, is going to be probably driven by finances.
It's just sort of hard for me without having a model out there to understand exactly what our options, what the state's options are in dealing with this issue. So.
Understood. The main reason I brought it up is just to point out that while financial institutions have that ability and or obligation to report, Family Protective Services is not going to investigate.
Right.
So they've got the report, but they're not going to investigate. And so then the financial institution can either report it to law enforcement or and see if somebody there is able to pursue it. So, and again, that's related to the spoliation matter, because when the individual is doing these types of transactions and they're involving Texans throughout the state, not just in one particular area, hundreds of family members, there's a percentage of those that are going to be 65 or older, or that had some other disability. And so that's where it captured those individuals, and that's where we were sensitized to the fact that, well, maybe that wasn't this individual's target audience, but as a consequence of their business model, it impacted them. So we made the reports and we've gone through that, and happy to continue to explore what, if anything, could be done with respect to meeting with other stakeholders and the other agencies.
Can I make one more comment, Mr. Chair? First, boy, I just hate hearing people that do that being referred to as having their business model affect a certain, but you're right, it's just wrong what they do. I think the simple fix to that, Mr. Chairman, in the long run, and it's not our purview, but I hope someone does it, is to strengthen the language over at the Family Protective Services, because they do investigate, and unfortunately, quite often come back and simply say, we aren't allowed to do anything about it. It'd be a tweak of the law, I think, for them to be able to refer it to somebody if there was a criminal change in the law.
Well, the investigators I've talked to just said, not in our jurisdiction.
Right.
The definition of exploitation in the finance code is broad, but the definition of exploitation in the human resources code is narrow, and we're going to follow that one. We realize you report to us, but we're following this definition, so we're not going to investigate it outside our jurisdiction.
Got it.
Thank you for the report.
And Ernest, just to clarify, we're just talking about institutions reporting, but also our own experience, because we too have been reporting financial elderly abuse that have run into the same situation ourselves.
Exactly. And that concludes my report. If there's any questions, be happy to try to answer those.
Do you all have any other questions?
Gentlemen?
Yes.
Could I ask, just with respect to at the federal level for a second, on legislative update, is there any update on the SAFE Act 120-day transitional bill for bank loan officers to move over to independent mortgage company loan officers?
Thank you. That's a good question. With regard to the SAFE Act, which as you all may all know, there's a Texas SAFE Act that's modeled on the federal SAFE Act. That's the big licensing act. Last May, the federal act was amended to allow for what's called temporary authority. And that temporary authority to originate without a license applies to two buckets of people, for lack of a better description. One being those who are registered to originate loans on the bank side who want to move to a mortgage company. And the second being those who are state licensed in another state and want to come to Texas and originate. And so what the federal law does is allow for those two populations, given that they meet various criteria and factors, that they can begin originating before they actually get a state license. They have to have applied for a state license, but they then have 120 days, basically grace period, that they could continue originating without a state license. And so different states are handling it differently. SML feels that we should, that has recommended that there be a modification to the state SAFE Act, because it currently says you can't originate without a license. And so we feel it would be helpful and would provide clarity for future if we have a section dealing with this temporary authority to align with the federal statute and to be clear about what Texas's law is. We have worked with Texas Mortgage Bankers Association, also sees it similarly. So we have been working with TMBA. We have passed any drafts we thought of to OCCC to make sure that we're covering any of Commissioner Pettyjohn's concerns as well. And currently, a draft is with Ledge Council.
Okay, great. And so that makes sense. Right now, for example, let me just put it in real work terms. If you worked for a mortgage company in Texas and you went to work for one of the big box banks, Wells Fargo, B of A, whatever, that's a very simple transition. But if you work for Wells Fargo or B of A or any of the large banks and you want to work for an independent mortgage company, there is no way to make that transition and do business immediately. You are out until you are licensed. So this bill grants a 120 day grace period so these people can do work and not be sitting on the sidelines for that 120 days. So that's why it's so important. It puts mortgage companies at a significant hiring disadvantage in hiring anybody from banks because of that period. So that helps frame it. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Any other questions for me? Okay, then that concludes our report, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Item C, Commissioner Pettyjohn.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Our report begins on page 31. Before I get into the material, I was just going to report, as I have been recently, some economic news of interest. We have some recent statistics from the Federal Reserve that 2018 ended with a notable increase in consumer credit. Statistics released by the Fed indicated consumer credit increased by a seasonally adjusted annual rate of 6.5% in the fourth quarter and 5% in December. Significant growth there, and some of the financial analysts are predicting that consumer credit growth is going to continue throughout much of 2019. last year we saw the highest volume in new auto loans or auto credit on record at $584 billion, and as of the fourth quarter of 2018, people with credit scores above 760 originated about 30% of our outstanding auto credit. And subprime borrowers seem to be responsible for 22% of all auto loan balances. In terms of U.S. household debt overall, 95.4% of balances were current, which is roughly on par with pre-recession levels. While auto loan delinquencies remain below their recession-era peak, they've been increasing slowly since 2014. About 4.47% of auto loan balances were delinquent in the fourth quarter. So not a large concern, seems fairly consistent, but just the rise in growth in consumer credit I thought was somewhat interesting. I wanted to share some of that. There was a question about auto loan delinquencies in the pensions, investments, and financial services hearing yesterday. So an issue of interest.
So what do you, is this a good thing or a bad thing?
Well, just the economic news is showing continued growth in consumer credit market, and many of the analysts are predicting that that will continue in 2019.
Is that a good thing or a bad thing?
It depends on your perspective. But markets are growing, and I mean, presumably consumers have access to this type of credit, and access to credit is often a very positive thing to help people improve their overall position. The prudent use of credit, of course, that's important, and that's a whole different conversation we'll get to in a minute. But
okay.
But generally, I think those are positive trends.
Okay.
I am interested on the auto sales number in particular, how that'll be affected by natural disasters, not just in Texas with Harvey, but what's been going on in California, and the weather disasters that have gone on, you know, the vortexes across the country for cold snaps and things, how that might impact the next set of numbers.
Right. Right, well, the Harvey,
The Harvey numbers are in there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think that's, you know, it was, the state was able to, you know, withstand that type of blow, and in fact, I think there might have been some, you know, for the auto market, there was certainly an increase in boom, and people having to acquire new vehicles, but.
I don't know if it was 60 Minutes or News or whatever, but the auto was in the news not that long ago about the delinquencies going up, and I was trying to, in my mind, get, you know, if salaries are increasing and we have low unemployment, you know, why is that going on? And they said something that makes sense to me is that the high level of student debt,
loan debt.
Is a direct correlation that most of those delinquencies are those kids that have a high student loan debt, and so they need their car for work, and just the combination of the two is pushing those delinquencies up.
That's probably a little bit consistent with what the question was yesterday, asking about that particular demographic, and the data I have doesn't speak specifically to that demographic. I just reported it overall, and it seems to be consistent with that demographic.
It makes sense to me, logically, that would be the correlation.
Okay. Any more comments about economics? Secondly, in small dollar lending news, I wanted to report about the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. As you remember, in October of 2017, the CFPB issued its final adopted rule with requirements for payday, title loans, and other high-cost consumer loans. And although this rule gets referred to as the payday rule, it covers several types of consumer loans, and some of which are not really considered to be payday loans. And the rule had two sets of requirements. The mandatory underwriting provisions, often also referred to as the ability to repay provisions, and then payment mechanism provisions. Last week, on February the 6th, under new leadership, the CFPB issued two new notices of proposed rulemaking regarding this previously adopted rule. In the first proposal, the CFPB is proposing to rescind the mandatory underwriting or ability to repay provisions. And this is based upon their current determination that the evidence that was used to support the provisions was not sufficient to show that the prohibitive practices were unfair or abusive. And then the second proposal, the CFPB proposes delaying the August 19, 2019 compliance date, so it was supposed to be effective this summer, for the mandatory underwriting provisions by 15 months to November 19, 2020. And this is based on input from industry participants stating they don't have sufficient resources to update their compliance management systems by August of 2019. And so both of these provisions relate to those underwriting provisions, the ability to repay. They won't affect the payment mechanism provisions. And so the CFPB had made some previous announcements, so this wasn't unexpected. They had made announcements in January of 2018 and October of 2018 explaining that they intended to reconsider the rule and its compliance date. So that was somewhat expected, but that's fairly recent action, and I wanted to be sure I updated you on that issue as well. So moving on to the reports. Page 31 begins our reports on the consumer protection and examination area, and you'll see for the first 4 months of the fiscal year 19, the exam process is on track with those prorated FY19 goals and fairly consistent with the activity in fiscal year 18 by comparison. A few little changes in one group, maybe higher or lower, but those will even out by the end of the year, should be. We have two groups of newly hired financial examiners that have completed their classroom training. They've been hard at work with their classroom training over the last several months, as well as some full field training. And so some of those groups are getting certified and moving on and being very productive in the new examination types. And so our area of field examiners is fully staffed, and that's a welcome status for them.
Congratulations.
Thank you. On page 30, for a week or two, probably. Mm-hmm. on page 32 is the acceptable level of compliance. You'll see that all areas are within an acceptable level of compliance. Again, it's only 4 months of activity, the top chart. you'll see a trailing 12-month chart at the bottom. So we've got one area that we're still working with CAPS, and we may continue to see some weakness in that area over the year, but we continue to work to try to improve that compliance posture. On page 33 is a report on investigations, and our investigation activity continues as normal, though we do see a substantial shift in the types of investigations we're doing. They are very much moving towards motor vehicle sales finance. That seems to be what's bubbling up in that area. 92.3% of our exams in the first 4 months of fiscal year 2019 are on motor vehicle sales finance. Unlicensed activity and repossessions are the top two issues in that category, so we continue to work on that that type of an investigation. Moving down to the bottom, page 33, you'll see information about complaints. The complaint processing level is fairly consistent year over year. From 18 to 19, we're up about 2.5%, but fairly consistent. We have added the non-jurisdictional complaints. Some of the data we're beginning to add in, some of the data that Sunset had requested, so you see the 50 non-jurisdictional complaints are added into the chart below. We've also added in some average number of days to close complaints, 51 days for all complaints. And there's another statistic I'll hit a little bit later on in a different chart on complaints. Page 34, further breakdown of information on the complaint types. But again, motor vehicle sales finance complaints are our largest category at 61%. Obviously, they're our largest category of licensee as well, so I mean, that's not terribly unusual. But otherwise, we see fairly normal activity on the breakdown of those that information on complaints. Moving on to licensing on page 36, we've just completed the renewal period for several types of our licensees, and we had very good retention rates over those credit access businesses. We had 97% completing the renewal. And again, this is an area that has, you know, facing a lot of uncertainty with federal rule, but really they've been holding fairly stable at a consistent level. We'll see that on the chart on page 37 here in just a second. But 97% completed renewal, 98% of our regulated lenders, and 85% of our property tax lenders. That was pretty close to in line with our projections, maybe just slight bit higher in a category or two, but that's close to what we projected. 90% of those were completed online. So we continue to see efficiency gains through the renewal process being completed online. So we're very grateful to see that, and hopefully it's as efficient for the industry as it is for us. One of the reports in the application processing, our pending application volume had grown quite a bit over the last year or so, and the licensing department has been working pretty hard to try to diminish that volume back down to what we believe to be a more level standard and within our benchmarks, and they were able to accomplish that, and so I congratulate them on that. We think that restores our processing time to a more normal level, so we're pleased with that performance. On page 37, you'll see the report of all the different trends of the licensed and registered groups. And again, nothing's very significant, very stable on this page. You'll see a pretty good little bump in regulated lenders in the first chart on the upper left, just in the last quarter. And then you'll also see a pretty significant jump in the chart immediately below it for refund anticipation loan facilitators. It's that time of the year when those groups get busy. There's quite a bit more activity in folks trying to help consumers get advances on their income tax refunds. And so that's, anyway, we see some heightened activity in that registration area. Page 38, the communications and HR administration report. I did want to mention a couple items on legislation here. I already mentioned the post hearing. Yesterday, you should be receiving, I think you're all getting our weekly legislative emails about the reports and what bills we're tracking and the items that we're showing. Obviously our two sunset bills are on that list. We have about 10 bills filed so far that would affect operations in the credit access business area. So we're monitoring those bills. There's one bill that would affect pawn shops, and then at least so far two other sort of general kind of credit, consumer credit related bills. They either cover multiple areas or some specific other general area. So we'll continue to monitor those and report and try to give you all as much information as you would like on any of those proposals. I'm aware of several more bill drafts going on. We'll be pretty heavy bill filing for the next 3 weeks or so till we hit the deadline on bill filing, which is coming up in just a few weeks. So we'll continue to provide you with that information on a weekly basis. Feel free to reach out to us if you need any extra information or questions. Moving on to HR, continue to work on just a few positions that we have outstanding, but we have two very significant retirements coming up at the end of the month, and I wanted to mention those. First of all, Kimberly Wilson, who is our information technology security analyst, is planning to retire. Kimberly has been with us for 18 years and has done a great job helping us grow our maturity in terms of our automated technology, our information technology resources, and our security posture. And so we're very grateful for her service. Sad to be losing her, but we know she has big plans in store, and so we're happy for her. And then the other retirement comes at the end of month is Rudy Aguilar. Rudy, back there somewhere. Rudy's been with the Office of the Consumer Credit Commissioner for 26 years, and he came in at a time when our exam department was contained quite a number of examiners that had been with the agency almost some since its inception. I mean, it was an older exam force. Although we had some new examiners as well, and Rudy has done a great job with it was pretty soon to be a almost complete turnover of the exam department, but has really taken that exam department and has shown great leadership and contributions in growing the examiners, the exam process, and the examiner training and the whole examiner force up to a highly professional group that we're very, very proud of, and I'm very pleased to just the work and the leadership and the contributions that he's made. And so we are very much going to miss him, and we're so grateful for his service. And we're working on transition plans and certainly working on the process to select a new director, but we, again, want to congratulate Rudy. If it's appropriate, Mr. Chairman, I think we can give him a round of
applause. And I'm reasonably confident that we're going to have to put a brass plaque on that chair that Rudy always sits in.
That might be appropriate.
Madam, if I can just make a comment,
please,
too.
Please.
Working in the industry and representing the industry, Rudy has always been one of the best people to work for and with across the country. I work in a number of states, and Rudy is recognized as a leader, so he will truly be missed, and I appreciate all your help over the years, Rudy.
Thank you.
You will miss him too. Okay, moving on to page 40. This is our HR questions. So a few comments. I think we even got some questions from commission members about the governor's initiative on against human trafficking. This is certainly a high priority in the legislature and for the governor, and they recently had a meeting and have really challenged agencies to step up for 100% participation, and so we've all been participating in that. Went to a meeting recently. They recognized agencies who had achieved the 100% participation, and so anyway, just wanted the commission to know that we're certainly committed to that project as well, and it's just been a high profile initiative across the state. Financial literacy at the bottom of page 40, I wanted to mention that there is going to be a financial literacy day at the Capitol on February the 27th, and so there is quite a few activities that are being planned, and our staff is involved a little bit in that and working towards that. Texas Jumpstart Coalition is working on that activity. There will be recognition, I think, as Financial Literacy Day. There's also several initiatives that they're working on. Obviously, they're working on increasing awareness, public awareness of personal financial literacy or personal financial education, and trying to promote various resources within the state. There's also two bills that have been filed, House Bill 1182 and Senate Bill 686. that would take the current personal financial literacy class that's often offered as a half hour or a half semester, one semester, a half a credit, it's called, a one semester class at the secondary education level. Right now it's an elective, but there is a effort that would, this bill would make that a required course. And so the bill has been filed by Representative Goodwin in the House and by Senator Alvarado in the Senate. Alvarado, sorry. But anyways, we'll see how that goes. But I know there'll be some discussion about that as well. And so we're obviously very interested in that issue and participating in the Financial Literacy Day. On page 41, moving into to information technology, I mentioned with the audit committee yesterday that we are completing an assessment through the DIR vendor on the Texas Cybersecurity Framework. That review is nearing its completion, and we expect we've scheduled a closeout meeting for the end of February. So we'll be awaiting that. Also at security updates, we are working on a massive security-driven rebuild of our Alex system. And that's also, we're beginning our user acceptance testing that has been pushed off. It said here it was expected the first week of February, and I think that's going to be pushed down to the first week of March because of some other conflicts and some other further work that needed to happen on that project. But we are continuing work on that, but we're looking forward to getting that accomplished. That's a huge accomplishment for us to get that done, and we're excited about getting to the end of that. And then I also wanted, I've been reporting to you on our phishing campaigns, and we use the Marriott data breach as a opportunity to run some phishing campaigns against our employees and try to bait them, and we sent it again to 52 employees who travel frequently, and 98% were successful in avoiding the attempted phish campaign. So anyway, we're grateful for that report.
Could I ask you a question before you go on to?
Sure.
So I noticed you had in there the paragraph right above that about the phishing and incorporating potential sites into the statewide blacklisting.
Yes.
So I didn't realize there was a statewide blacklist until I had read that. Yes. How do they blacklist some phishing? Is it a blacklist of phishing sites? Are they able to block them, or what do they do?
Well, through DIR has, a lot of our traffic comes through them. They alert us even from time to time when they spot things that come through traffic-wise. So they're monitoring things as well. So they have, I can't give you the technical.
That's a master list?
Yeah, but they can set, they have settings and ways that they can technically block particular IP addresses or whatever they need to block, that, or addresses that they can, and we report those things. They want us to report some of those.
Okay.
So they're maintaining that. Any of the IT people in the room care to?
Just didn't know.
Just add additional information. Okay. On page 42, this is our some of our standard measures we report to you, and I just wanted to mention on money's return to consumers. I know that the second quarter has been particularly active, so we'll expect to see some pretty significant results in that area in the second quarter when that data is ready. Also wanted to point out another one of our statistics that we've reported for many, many years, this percentage of written complaints closed within 90 calendar days that was referred to earlier, that we're currently at 85.2%. That's roughly our benchmark. It's nice to have it above 90, but again, the complexity of complaints has continued. Some of these go to enforcement actions. Some of them have gone to field investigations. So 85% is generally, I think, a reasonable benchmark for that type of activity. Additional performance measures on page 43. For the first quarter, we are meeting or exceeding all six of those key output measures. And then I think that concludes all the information in the regular reports. I think we're ready for the legal report with Michael, unless there are any other questions I can answer first.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Michael Rigby, General Counsel for the Office of Consumer Credit Commissioner. The legal report starts on page 44 of your materials, and I have a few updates for you. On that page 44, there's a contested case description that resulted in a default back in December. The proposal for decision was forwarded to our agency, and a final order was issued
after, in early February, after these materials were prepared, the respondent has 25 days under the Administrative Procedures Act to file a motion for rehearing, so that deadline will fall in early March. Right below that, there's a section describing credit access business unregistered activity. Wanted to kind of give you a little more background on that because that's something we haven't seen a lot of until now. The Chapter 393 has two requirements to hold a license at the CAB. One is that you're registered as a credit services organization with the Texas Secretary of State, and the other is that you get licensed with us. We discovered that several of our licensees were not, in fact, currently registered with the Texas Secretary of State. At the same time that we were analyzing the situation, we also received a complaint from Texas Appleseed, which raised the same concern. We issued 22 enforcement orders in January. One of those we withdrew because the licensee was able to provide us with evidence that showed that they were in fact registered with the Texas Secretary of State. Before we issued the orders, we wanted to make sure that we had our facts right, so we sent letters to these folks and said, you know, it looks like you're not registered. Can you, you know, confirm that or show us why you are in fact registered? Despite that, the records of the Texas Secretary of State were not accurate with that one individual licensee, so we withdrew the order. And that's all I have as far as updates goes. I'll be happy to take any questions. Or... Great. Thank you.
One more item, Mr. Chairman, and then we'll be finished. It's on the very last page of our report, page 48, the rule schedule. There's an omission on this that we are working on, and that's our complaint procedures rule, and we are in the planning stages on the complaint procedures rule. Just wanted to point that out as well. And that will conclude our report.
Commissioner Cooper.
Mr. Chairman, our report starts on page 51. Before I go into detail, I would like to make a couple of, announcements. As all of y'all know, Bob Bacon, a longtime employee and deputy commissioner, retired. We went through the process of posting that publicly and internally, and Kurt Purdom has accepted that position, and Kurt, a fairly newcomer with the department, only been with us for 37 years, so we'll try to teach him a little bit about what's going on. But congratulations, Kurt. Then one move creates another, so Kurt was the director of our bank and trust division, and so his position became open, and we posted that, and Dan Frazier, that's right behind Dan, I think all of you know Dan. Dan has been promoted to that position. Dan's been with the department for 10 years, and I think prior to that, he was with the OCC for, what, about 16 years, Dan?
That's right.
So 26 years of experience, so that position is in capable hands. Now Dan's position, Dan was a director of the corporate activities, Dan's position is open and has been posted, and we're in the process of selection there. So again, one move creates another. I would like to tell y'all that Phil Lena, who some of y'all know, Phil's been with the department for 31 years. Phil will retire at the end of this month. Phil is in strategic support and been a commission examiner, so many people know Phil, so that will be a loss, but again, that will create a vacancy. So I think some positive activity going on. So on 51, again, I just hit the high spots. Our number of banks has gone down to 233 from the last report at 236. And then you say the number of trust companies and foreign bank agencies that we have, and then down at the bottom, our problem loans, those are rated 3, 4, and 5, are at 11. And as I mentioned to the committee yesterday, that again, that number bounces around from 10 to 11 to 12. It is probably a number that will be hard to go below that number for many reasons.
And Charles, in terms of CAMEL's rating, is there any consistency among those 11, or are there a variety of things that cause them?
I said yesterday the consistency is every once in a while somebody will do something silly. So the consistency is people do things silly. But as far as what aspect, some of it is safety and soundness. Most of it is safety and soundness issues where their problem assets go up or their liquidity problems. Some of it could be related to BSA or other type activity. But I was asked yesterday, do these just stay there? No, they don't. They come on, and then probably within a year they go off and somebody takes their place.
Charles, is your de novo open?
Pardon me?
Your de novo? Did you have a new application, right?
The last application we had opened in 2017, we have discussions with two groups that have indicated an intention to file, but we have not received that filing yet.
Do they go in on this report and not rate it initially?
Yes. Then, on page 52, let's go over and just mentions our enforcement actions. That number stays consistent. I will say down at the bottom of the page talks about our compliance with examination priorities. 2155 allowed banks between $1 and $3 billion to be allowed to go into the 18-month exam cycle. Previously, we examined them every 12 months. The way this schedule works is that some of these are hitting toward the end of the year altogether. And so this may create a little bit of, it will create a backlog on our examination schedule, but we hope to remain in compliance with our priorities. I'd like to go to page 54, and this would be the corporate division activity. 54 talks about the applications process. 55 tells you where they are. Then I want to mention down at the middle of the page talks about the activity. So Veritex Bank completed its acquisition of Green Bank, and that's a $4.4 billion acquisition. So as for the number of banks, it has no impact on the number of banks, but it does impact the number of assets. Then Independent Bank McKinney acquired Guaranty Bank and Trust in Denver, Colorado, and that is a $3.7 billion acquisition. So if you go back over on the chart where it says we have $257 billion in assets as of 11:30, next report will probably have an increase somewhere around $11 billion, so that's not inconsequential. Again, the number of banks doesn't change, but as I've mentioned to y'all before, generally speaking, the banks that we have are the survivors in these acquisitions.
Charles, how does that work when it comes to what you charge the banks for examination? So in other words, is it a quarterly assessment that you do, and it's based upon the asset size at the end of the quarter?
So we don't charge for examinations, we charge for the assessment. So
right,
yes, it would. So the next quarter after the acquisition, it will start kicking in. For instance, if it's, I think some of these will be effective in maybe January, and so we'll pick it up in the first quarter or the March quarter. Special audits, I would say on page 58, we'd call it just a lot of information there. I would say that everything remains roughly the same. On page 57 talks about some past due examinations, but we expect that the first quarter will, we will still meet or exceed the performance standards. I want to just mention a couple of things down at the bottom. It talks about Director Reese attended the Money Transmission Regulators Association. Money, MTRA is the National Association for Money Transmission Regulators, and Russell has been a director. Previously, Stephanie Newberg was the president of that organization. And then last paragraph, we had the, everything has initials by it, but the Multi-State MSB Examination Task Force, or MMET, we met at the same time in Fort Worth with the MTRA. And the MMET that I guess I'm still the chairman, our job is to coordinate the multi-state MSB examinations. And that is becoming more important as each one of our licensees, if they operate nationally, are licensed in every state. And so instead of every state going into an examination, we try to coordinate these activities, and it's through this MMET that we do that. So we are stressing through CSBS the importance of states either participating in the multi-state examination or and or accepting that examination as opposed to doing an independent exam. That is less burden on the licensee, and we just think it's good practice. So we're really spending a lot of time and discussion about that initiative.
Charles, can I ask a question?
Yes.
So I saw last week sometime that on Bitcoin, the Florida case, they ruled Bitcoin as money transmission. So are you thinking that that's a precursor to what's to come, or I'm just curious?
Well, I appreciate you sending me that. We are evaluating that outcome of that case, where we are. There's just a lot of discussion about Bitcoin right now. We do not license, it is not considered money transmission in Texas because of the definition of, it doesn't meet the definition. So we're just gonna look at that, kind of see where it is. It's very interesting. Then beginning on page 58, you have the our FTEs, and we have, per this, about 17 positions that are open. We've had some hires since this information was presented, and we have some postings going on. For instance, we have 11 vacancies in Bank and Trust, and we have about 5 active postings. And so hopefully we'll be able to get some of those positions filled. We recently hired a law clerk that filled, that had 3 vacancies in legal, and we've had 2 of those filled. So again, hopefully some new blood coming in. Performance measures start on 59, and we're in compliance with all of this. On page 60, there is a email from Lori Wright, our director of HR. Lori's in the back. We sent out to y'all, let me back up. We did a survey, a voluntary survey that we initiated, and we do this on even years, and to personnel, and we did the Survey Monkey about the issues, and y'all got a copy of the survey. And kind of the high point on this is that we have 166 or 95% of staff completed. 89 of the 166 basically said they were satisfied and chose not to go any further on the survey. And then the remainders did. But punchline or bottom line on this is that we thought it was a good survey. Some of the things that came up or out of the survey we have discussed, and we have action plans for improvement, and we're also, our employee advisory council is reviewing this, and will be providing us with information. So any questions on that? Beginning on 61 would be the strategic support analysis. It has the complaints that it's basically just the, I would say continuation of the trend we have with nothing unusual in there. On page 64, I mentioned earlier, down at the bottom of the page, I mentioned that Phil was retiring at the end of the month. Our lead consumer assistant specialist, Sean Farley, was promoted to corporate analyst. So again, a great promotion for her, and that would possibly create a slot for us to try to fill. We are tracking roughly 41 bills at the legislature, and y'all get activity or reports on those. I think maybe that is, I think as Leslie said, a lot of bill filing. I think that number will go up. And we rate these as for order of importance. Some of them are just because of the words come out the way they are, and we are interested, obviously, in that bill, but some of it affects us or our industry directly. So some of them get more attention than others, but all of them get attention. And so, Mr. Chair, that's all I have until have Catherine Ryer needs to go over our legal division report. Y'all have any questions on my report? Catherine, will you come forward, please?
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members. Catherine Ryer, General Counsel, Texas Department of Banking. So the legal division report for the Department of Banking begins on page 66 in your materials. A couple of items in the report that I'd like to bring to your attention. The first matter concerns the unauthorized sale of prepaid funeral merchandise that I mentioned, and I think we had a little bit of discussion at our last meeting. Wanted to give you an update. As you can see, today is the deadline for Mr. Peel to make the restitution payment to us. We have received information that Mr. Peel has been hospitalized. He's had several medical issues, so he has been hospitalized. He has also been actively attempting to sell the funeral home, and it is the proceeds from that sale that we expect to fund the restitution. So it appears that he will not make the deadline of today to make the restitution payment. However, we fully anticipate that he will make the payment by the end of this month. We are in constant communication with his attorney on this matter, and we will continue to receive that information, and if necessary, we will make a referral to the Attorney General's office for enforcement of the order. But I did want to let you know that it appears that he is not going to make the February 15th deadline. Any questions on that? On the next page, a bit of good news. The agency was able to receive reimbursement of tuition and travel expenses for some IT and cybersecurity training for 11 members of our staff in October and November, and so we received those reimbursements, and we see that as a very positive way for us to continue enhancing the education on that very important issue for our staff.
If I could just to follow up on that, I reported to y'all several meetings ago that this came through CSBS, so that they are paying for that. We hope that by the end of this year that all of our financial examiners will have received this training. We think that's going to be very important for our people that go out and interact with the banks, that they'll now be able to have this important training and can help our banks in this regard in cybersecurity.
The next item is interesting. We had requested an Attorney General opinion back in May of last year, and we did finally receive the opinion back from the Attorney General's office. The issue there had to do with older prepaid funeral contracts that did not specify the manner of disposition of the body. Since, I think, 2002, the form has now changed so that the manner of disposition is specifically required to be selected. But prior to then, the manner was not required to be selected. So there were some instances, there were some questions, basically, that came up when the manner was not selected, whether the decedent's intent could be inferred from surrounding documents. And it was very murky, we felt, from a legal standpoint, so we requested the opinion. The Attorney General came back and said, no, the decedent's intent cannot be inferred from those surrounding documents. So that has been some assistance to our industry members who raised the question with us, and we've instructed our examiners accordingly that they may not look to those other related documents for the intent, and they can only focus on the contract itself. Any questions on that? And I think that's really all I wanted to bring to your attention today.
I have a question.
Yes.
Going back to on the page 66, the second item, Isabel.
Yes.
I'm just curious. When the text starts, says Rubio, a sovereign citizen. So they she must have stated she is, or.
Yes, since I've been at the agency, I've seen a couple of these come across, and essentially there are some individuals who assert that they are a sovereign citizen and therefore they are not subject to the laws of the state of Texas that you and I recognize as the laws of the state of Texas. And I think the nature of this action had to do with a foreclosure. And so this individual has asserted that she, as a sovereign citizen, is not subject to the foreclosure laws, and I think she named, actually, Commissioner Cooper in this lawsuit. And so we referred it to the AG, as we do with these, and my understanding is that the individual that filed the lawsuit her deadline to respond to the AG's motion to dismiss passed. She did not file the motion. Now we're just waiting for the judge to make a ruling. Yeah. It's an interesting legal concept.
Yeah. I didn't know it was an actual category. So.
Google it.
Yeah.
Your eyes will be open.
Yeah.
You have a lot to read.
Any other questions?
Thank you.
Thank you.
That concludes our report.
At this time, the Finance Commission will take a 10-minute break. The time is 9:52. It is 10:03 on February the 15th, 2019. At this time, the Commission will go into closed session pursuant to Government Code Sections 551.071, 551.076, and 551.089 to discuss agenda items A6 and A10. At this time, to discuss agenda item A10, the Commission requests that all non-commissioned members leave the room, with the exception of the Department of Information Resources Representative Susie Hilliard, AT&T Representative Kevin Rod, and the following agency staff members: Charles Cooper, Stephanie Newberg, Kurt Purdom, Catherine Ryer, Joe Braz, and Dale Harvard. I'll read the next section to you.
Yeah.
Following the discussion of item 10, the Commission will discuss items A6. At that time, the Commission will request that all non-commissioned members leave the room, with the exception of the following agency staff members: Charles Cooper, Stephanie Newberg, Kurt Purdom, Catherine Ryer, Carolyn Jones, Stephanie Trotty, Antonia Antoff, Ernest Garcia, Stephen O'Shields, Leslie Pettijohn, Michael Rigby, and Juan Garcia. M on February the 15th, 2019, and the Commission now is back in open session. No action was taken in closed session. Somewhere I have a script on closing the session.
Chairman Plunkett, we have these signed affirmations, whoever needs.
Yeah, you'll just leave on the table.
Signed affirmation.
Is there any other business?
Meeting? Mr. Chairman, did we just approve the minutes from the last meeting? I don't remember.
We did.
Okay.
We did that.
Okay, got it, yeah, okay.
Consent.
Okay.
I've done that, yeah. Okay, the meeting is adjourned.
Time?
I did the time.
No.
I can be home by 1:00.
10:57.
Wow.
Yes, that's the last one.
Wow.
Wow.